fields of bodies burning as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
Hi, this is Bob Petrakis bringing you the other side of the news.
And I'm Dan Dugan, the other guy on the other side. WGRN, the Green Renaissance.
This is Bob Petrakis bringing you the other side of the news. You're listening to WGRN 94.1 and WCRS 92.7 and 98.3 on your dial. And I have Dr. Marilyn Howard in the studio, who teaches Black Studies at Columbus State. She's got a master's in political science, and her doctorate is in history. And her dissertation was on lynchings in the Buckeye State. But tonight's first topic is, should we be carried back to old Virginia?
The cradle of the Confederacy? Are we surprised at this? You know, this. If the lieutenant governor were to move into that seat, he'd be the second one after Douglas Wilder. But yes, it's the whole thing has a kind of...
But the number one guy,
the
governor, on his personal page, there was, again, a man dressed in blackface standing next to somebody dressed up like a Klan member.
Full regalia. Big top hat and everything.
And the number three guy admitted that he also dressed up, well, he didn't say blackface, but in dark makeup. What do you make of that as a scholar? Is dark makeup different than blackface?
It is if you're white. It is if you're white. And, of course, if you were dark, dark, African dark, like Lupita Nyong'o or something, you wouldn't need that. You wouldn't have to worry. But if you've got to put something on your face to make you look darker, yeah, that counts too.
Well, you know, I don't want to get too much into the psychosexual dynamics of this, but what is it about white people wanting to dress up as black people? Do black people ever get together and go, what is wrong with those people?
Yeah, we do when we have parties, because white people give such dull parties, we have to have our own.
Well, in ethnic notions, yeah. The documentary,
yes,
the suggestion is that it's some sort of cathartic liberation for really repressed white people who, you know, kind of see black culture as more open, fun, tolerant than the rigidity of white racist culture.
That's where you get slumming in Harlem in the 1920s. It's exotic. It's, you know, they're so primitive, and they're so in touch with their feelings. And white people, you know, are generally so repressed in terms of that. And so, yeah, there is that. But, you know, this all goes back to good old-fashioned racism. An anti-black feeling. Again, we've got Virginia, the cradle of the Confederacy. And we've got, what's odd about this incident is that he couldn't remember which of the characters he was, but he's in the picture. And now somebody got a physical copy of the book, and he looked and he said, now he's neither of those characters. And then 2 days after that, he said, well, I did dress up in blackface once to go to a party. And so the story keeps changing. Yes, he moonwalked, he said. Or he can moonwalk. He didn't demonstrate that, thank goodness. But
now, I was in the Detroit area there in the early 80s when the moonwalk was in vogue. And I used to think it was weird when I'd go out to Dearborn, which a racist suburb, trying, you know, keep Dearborn clean, which meant keep blacks from moving into Dearborn.
Right, that's right.
Yeah, Orville Hubbard, the mayor. But I'd remember these kids walking around, you know, they weren't wearing blackface, but they were dressed like Michael Jackson.
Yeah, doing the moonwalk.
And they had one glove.
I actually, at that time period, was dating someone who was white, and he had some nieces and nephews, and I was over there for dinner, and I had to, the kids entertained us by moonwalking like Michael Jackson. So, you know what? I hadn't thought about that for decades. I must have repressed that experience way back in my head. That and breakdancing. Yeah, they showed us their breakdancing, these white suburban kids. So I do think there is something to it. It's odd that white people think they want to... When people talk about having safe places and things like that, and that's a whole other show, I think, but that they, it's like, well, why can't I come? Why can't I play? Why can't you? Why don't you include me? It's almost like they're, well, why can't I come to your safe place? So what is it about black culture that is so interesting or something to white people that they feel that, you know,
okay,
they have to do that?
Okay, let me say, moonwalking, Tennessee waltz. One seems a little funner than the other one.
Well, you know, and this is why people need a whole cultural thing on all kinds of things. You get fixated on this one thing or something. But this whole blackface thing and the whole pretending and you do have to wonder, it's 2019. And I just cannot believe that people don't get it, that they don't know that this is wrong. You know, he says, well, it was back in, what, 1984, and so the context.
Well, it was a long time. Yeah. 1984, that's...
Yes.
I thought the civil rights era was passed.
Yeah, and I don't know.
And over by then.
And now we have this woman on The View who admitted that she dressed up for Halloween as a beautiful African woman. And that she had to use dark makeup.
For what?
It was a Halloween costume. I'm going to tell you something. When I dressed up for Halloween, I went as a princess. I borrowed my sister's faux fur jacket and long black gown, and I wore some high heel shoes for my mother, and I dressed as a princess. So
you went as a white suburban woman. You called up Finger Hut, and you got some polyester stretch pants.
Yeah, so I don't get it. I don't get the attraction for this, and I do think this is very deeply rooted in old-fashioned racism, and anybody who tries to say I'm not a racist or I didn't do that is just blowing smoke out of their you know where. This is the base of this is just racism.
We're talking with Dr. Marilyn Howard, a professor at Columbus State. And a teacher of black studies, and she's trying to make sense out of it for us about this blackface stuff. But a lot of those the blackface humor was, you know, incredibly racist, and the fact that black actors, that black people weren't playing black roles.
Yeah.
You know, it was Jewish and Irish guys that were expressing themselves.
It goes back so much further than people recognize. We can trace blackface back to the 1830s.
And the minstrel show.
And the minstrel show, yes. And that's M-I-N-S-T-R-E-L.
I mean, that essentially, the history of the Jim Crow character was essentially a white guy imitating a crippled black man restricted by statutes that wouldn't let you dance and which define dance as crossing your legs.
Yes, yes. And so and it became a really popular kind of entertainment. It's kind of like a precursor to vaudeville.
But it was a white guy.
It was a white man.
Mimicking a stereotype of a physically impaired black man,
but
who couldn't cross his legs in dancing because white people wouldn't allow it.
Well, and it kind of morphed into I'm pretending to be a stupid black person, especially a stupid black slave.
And this was brought to small towns
yes.
in Indiana and in Ohio.
And there's actually a Jim Crow song. I've used it in class before. One of my students said she went home that evening and told my mother, she's going to make us learn the Jim Crow song.
Kind of spin but, around and twirl.
Yes,
and dance.
Jump Jim Crow.
Every time I turn around, I jump Jim Crow.
And it's like the verses and things could be changed depending on what was going on at that particular time in that particular locale and things like that. And we see what developed were companies of black actors who did minstrel show work.
And they had their own stereotypes that fit in. You're right, the question,
yes.
Right, there was usually a smart, good-looking white woman with a, quote, pickaninny
yeah.
who who is out of control. And
but you know, and I talk to students. We talk to students about contemporary relativism or relevance. You know, one of the things I say, can you think of an example today of that? You know, that was supposedly one of the reasons why Dave Chappelle was, you know, kind of unhappy with his work. People weren't getting the socio-political, historical satire and that kind of thing. They were just tied up in all the silly antics, and that bothered him. And so, yeah, but it this is, again, just goes all the way back to plain old racism.
All right. And you've been working on a book review.
Yes.
For the Free Press. What's the new book you're going to review for us and let us know what you think of it?
Well, before I do, though, I want to encourage people to back up your computer stuff. Because I did not, and my hard drive died.
It's Dr. Marilyn Howard with some good advice.
So back up your stuff. But no, I just finished a writing review about a book called Mississippi Epiphany. And it is a
Mississippi Epiphany.
Yeah, and it's about
good alliteration.
It's about the trip that then the junior Democratic senator from New York State, Robert Kennedy. It's about the trip that he made to Mississippi. He was on a Senate subcommittee.
What year was that?
This was 1967. He was on a Senate subcommittee that was investigating the effectiveness of the Economic Opportunity Act, which was the cornerstone of the Great Society.
That's not the one with all those pictures of people in dire, unbelievable poverty,
That would be the one.
Oh,
and one of the witnesses they heard was a young NAACP attorney who had been born and reared in the South named Marion Wright. And
uh-huh.
She reported that there were actually black people in Mississippi who had no income, zero. Zip, not a zilch.
I have this image. I don't know if I'm getting it, but somebody like dressed in a grain sack, right? People that were so poor.
Not much up. I mean, these are kids who didn't have shoes and clothes, so they didn't go to school. These were one of the houses, one of the most famous of the scenes out of that is he went to a house and there's a little, look like a two-year-old child, and he's sitting on the floor, and what he's doing is picking up the grains of rice that have dropped and putting them in his mouth. You know, it was a lot of these children only ate once a day, if at all. A lot of parents went without so their kids could have that one thing, and so they ate things like rice and gravy or gravy and fat back or something like that, living in shacks with no modern conveniences. We're talking about the very basic modern conveniences, such as indoor plumbing and furnaces and things like that. And so when Marion Wright was testifying about this, the committee decided, hey, let's go see for ourselves. And it's a real shock. It's one thing to hear somebody talk about that. It's another thing to be down there and see, you know, how people are living. And people who were close to Robert Kennedy, they all say that that was a seminal experience for him, and it may be the thing that pushed him over into taking on Lyndon Johnson in 1968.
And what else? You're reading the book. Was there anything in there that you didn't know or hadn't really reflected on?
An interesting backstory was this is when Marion Wright met one of Kennedy's staffers, Peter Edelman. And Kennedy was assassinated on June 4th, 1968, and Wright and Edelman were married a month later. And so last year was their 50th wedding anniversary.
Interesting. This is WGRN 94.1, also WCRS 92.7, 98.3. This is Dr. Bob Fetrakis. I'm speaking with Dr. Marilyn Howard, an expert on black history. And again, 50 years anniversary. And that was right after Bobby Kennedy won the California primary.
Yes.
Looked like he was going to get the nomination for the Democratic Party and most likely would have ended up President of the United States. What do you think about the new calls to reopen the assassinations of the Kennedy brothers and Martin Luther King?
Yes. His son, I think Robert Kennedy Jr., has written a book about that. He said he's never believed that Sirhan was the only person involved in that. And there's another interesting backstory to that. There's a very iconic picture, I think a Pulitzer Prize-winning picture, of a young busboy who is on the floor with Robert Kennedy, and he's cradling his head so he doesn't have to have his head on a cold cement floor. And as he's bleeding profusely, the young man took a rosary out of his pocket, put it in Kennedy's hand. He said Kennedy asked if things were okay, and the young man said yes, and Kennedy said, okay, everything will be all right, and he never lapsed into unconsciousness. That young man, probably for 47 years, was so much haunted by that. Several years ago, was able to go to visit Robert Kennedy's grave and sort of reconcile himself with that. And he died. So he died last year. So, there's still kind of like fallout from that.
And again, what do you think? Good idea or bad idea to reopen the...
I'm not sure
the Kennedy and King assassination.
Yeah, I'm not sure what we... It would be a good idea if it would be an open investigation, but
they're not planning on releasing all of the files to like 2037.
And
why are you going to look at it if you're holding back the files?
So exactly, and so we know that they really have no intention of being open about it. So my thing is to just let it alone.
Any inklings? All three killed by lone crazed gunmen. The three of the most powerful men in the world.
Well, I'm of two minds with
without
that.
Anyone else involved on any level.
Yeah, I'm of two minds on that. One is that stuff happens that we can never explain, and the other one is, if you're buying that story, I've got a bridge in New Jersey to sell you. A used car or something I'd like to offload on you. Yeah.
It's a shame the reported Delta Force that had King under surveillance didn't warn him.
He had switched hotels. Because he was
they had actually baited him into switching hotels, right?
Yeah,
because there was a whole campaign that he was too uppity and
to stay in a black-owned place. Right? And so, he's a proud black man, and
which made him far more vulnerable and far more easy to shoot.
And I just saw on the news a couple nights ago, Jesse Jackson and Andy Young last year visited the balcony there. And, Jesse Jackson's in his 70s. Andy Young is 86, I think. And they were talking about that. And they talked about, that very iconic picture where they're pointing toward where the shot came from. He said originally the police were not running in that direction. They were running in the opposite direction. So, there are things like that just cannot be explained. But, again, as we know, they're not going to release everything that we need to look at. And so at that point, I think it's just an exercise in futility.
But the last time the House looked at it in 1976, they found more likely than not they were all assassinations involving more than one person.
Yes,
was, in fact, a conspiracy only takes two.
That's it. Yeah.
And that the notion that all three were killed by one lone crazed gunman without help from anyone... The House Committee on Assassination didn't buy that.
No. And I can understand the families and people talk about...
Well, the King family...
They filed a civil lawsuit. Yes, they did.
To say that it wasn't just James Earl Ray. Yeah.
And I can understand that, but I just think that there's really no such thing as closure. And go back to say they are not going, the government or whoever's going to be running this investigation, they are not going to release everything that needs to be seen. So, again, I think it's an exercise in futility.
And again, some would point out that also change figures on the right, like George Wallace, ended up being shot.
Yes.
And of course, others as well were gunned down, like the Kingfish.
Yes, and Medgar Evers.
Yeah, Huey Long. Well, Medgar Evers, it's pretty clear that the Klan shot him.
Well, you,
white racist.
You know, the thing about that was he was taken to a white hospital, and somebody recognized him and said, we need to take him over to the colored hospital, and they stopped him from doing that.
By the, so,
died at a white hospital. Yeah, but, you know, I can, there's, I get it, this, but I don't know, maybe this is lost to history or whatever, but unless people are going to make everything available, then these are just dog and pony shows.
All right. Getting back to the book, and parts of it that probably don't deal with this book, but one question that is often ignored is when you look at the South and the Kennedy brothers, is how reluctant both of them were to exert federal authority in the South. I mean, they had 400 at one point when the Klan's trying to burn down. Was it in Birmingham?
Yeah,
burn down the church with King inside of it. I mean, you got 400 federal marshals fighting hand to hand combat with half of them going to the hospital.
Yeah, they are certainly complicit, as we would say now, in some of the violence. There's and the thing that Robert Kennedy did repeatedly, you know, when he was the Attorney General and people talk about racism and stuff, well, my grandparents came from Ireland and they were the recipients of racist kinds of things and that kind of thing. You know, it's not the same thing. But they, you know, the dithering.
And they didn't surround the local Catholic church and try to burn it down.
Yeah,
maybe before the Civil War, maybe in the 1840s in New York or during the draft riots. But during his lifetime,
there
really wasn't that kind of blatant discrimination.
And they thought it was something that they could contain or control. The freedom.
Well, they sort of waffled, didn't they? I mean, now, Ike, look at Dwight Eisenhower. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, Little Rock, Arkansas, you're not going to let them in. Call out to Airborne. I'm going to go get the 101st and give every kid a paratrooper.
And the thing about Eisenhower, though, is that in his head, this was about, you know, rank. And when you get an
appointment, you're defying the general.
Exactly.
Insubordination.
And so that, you know, he looked at that as a constitutional thing. And that you are defying the federal
and
law.
And the Kennedys, but, being liberals from Boston, worried about a new civil war breaking out.
I think they were worried about, you know, it was the time of the Cold War, and it was a time when countries on the continent of Africa and Asia were, as King said, moving with jet-like speed toward independence, when American black people were still creeping at a horse and buggy rate to get a cup of coffee. And it made them look bad. The Soviets, as they did in the early 20th century with the Scottsboro Boys and any number of things, the Soviets were just making hay with
all. So you're telling me
stuff.
The Soviets, a.k.a. the Russians, were interfering in American politics.
Go figure.
What next? You're going to tell me they were involved in getting Jackie Robinson into the major leagues?
Possibly. It's entirely possible.
Well, a lot of the Communist Party newspaper covered it all the time, and Senate supporters, you know, that whole notion that there was a Cold War and, you know, we fought World War II with the Jim Crow Army was great propaganda. Mm-hmm. From the, for
exactly,
the Soviet
it was.
Union.
It was. And you know what's slightly amusing in the ironic sense of the way is I've been, you know, looking at things. It is Black History Month or African American History Month, and I was paging through some photos on the computer about unknown civil rights workers, people such as Fannie Lou Hamer or Septima Clark or something like that, that, you know, people hear about King and all that. Well, one of the pictures that popped up was a picture of Branch Rickey. So apparently he's an unknown civil rights worker.
Just north by 23 someplace, there's like a Branch Rickey Road. Just this one section.
So he
was from Ohio.
Yes, he was an unknown civil rights worker. So I thought that was amusing.
Yeah.
Got to laugh to keep from crying.
So are you working on any projects?
I am. I'm on a research sabbatical this term. And as you mentioned, I wrote my doctoral dissertation about the lynching of black men by white mobs in Ohio from 1876 to about 1911. I have discovered about four or five lynchings of black men in Ohio by white mobs that occurred before 1876 and several after my cutoff date.
I remember one of your theories is that you wouldn't get lynched if you had someone devout
right,
for
yeah,
you.
Yeah,
that's Ned's boy.
Yeah,
Ned's guy.
In the dissertation, I was talking about a theory that a sociologist had developed that there were four criteria that had to be met before somebody would be lynched, and if that didn't happen, one of which was, you know, a white person could step forward and
vouch for
you, then that person might not be lynched. But, you know, I'm
even if he was in town after sundown?
In town, and those sundown towns are mostly in the north. but clearly, again, this has, I'm not going to talk about that because it's too esoteric for people. I want people to read my stuff. And so I'm looking at it this time from the lens of Northern racism, which most people don't know exists. I was just talking to somebody a few days ago.
But you've always emphasized the fact that King said he felt the most afraid in Chicago.
In Chicago, yes.
In Cicero.
Yes.
Crazy white people, totally out of control.
Yeah, people don't realize the depth of racism in the North. And this is
and
it.
The people in the North weren't used to being around black people. In the South,
yes.
I mean, there's a long history of integration.
Exactly.
From Strom Thurmond, so to speak, to, right, I mean, assign your middle class, you had a black maid.
Yeah, well, you know, when I was growing up, I would hear older people, my grandparents, my aunts and uncles, there was a saying, I've never forgotten it, up north, they don't care how high you get as long as you don't get too close. Down south, they don't care how close you get as long as you don't get too high.
Uh-huh.
And if you think about Northern racism, things such as busing and stuff, this is all about physical proximity, because physical proximity implies equality.
And a lot of the race riots in the North happened on public transportation, trolley cars, you know, in Detroit and elsewhere. And it really was about crossing boundaries.
It was.
There were very specific streets, for example, in Detroit, that if you were black, particularly a black male, you weren't supposed to be on the other side of Greenfield.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things my students, we look at during World War II is that, you know, the defense industry had ratcheted up because of the war, and one of the plants was going to hire two black men for something other than mopping the floor, and there was a full-scale riot over two. There, you know, 1,000 people in that plant. You're going to have two black people. And so, again, proximity or closeness is about, it means equality.
Yeah, I remember Marty Glaberman, a historian, wrote a book, Black Cats, White Cats, and Wild Cats, where white workers in the middle of a war go on strike because they're bringing black workers.
That's right.
And
they use
the factory.
Black, yeah, exactly.
All right, well, thank you, Dr. Marilyn Howard, for being on the Other Side of the News, WGRN 94.1. WCRS 92.7 and 98.3. Thanks.
Always a pleasure.
And you can read Marilyn Howard, Dr. Howard's reviews in the Free Press and at freepress.org. Thanks for listening to The Other Side of the News. This is Bob Fitrakis.
And Dan Dugan, WGRN 94.1, LPFM, The Green Renaissance.